This is American Dissident Voices. This is a program speaking for Americans who believe in freedom rather than in political correctness, who value quality above equality, and are willing to do whatever must be done to restore America to racial and moral health and her public institutions to sanity and integrity. This is a program speaking for Americans who dissent from the United States government's policies of multiculturalism and enforced diversity and globalism. This program is the voice of America's dissidents who are speaking out to America's patriots and to patriots of our Western civilization around the world in order that we may learn together and work together for a better future for us all.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week marks two milestones in American history, the 60th anniversary of D-Day and the death of Ronald Reagan. And with us to discuss these issues today is one of the most incisive historical minds our nation has produced, the courageous researcher, scholar, and publisher, the director of the Institute for Historical Review, Mr. Mark Weber. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much, Kevin. That's very generous. It's a pleasure being on the show again.
Mark, not far from where I sit in Bedford, Virginia, is the National D-Day Memorial, where wreath-laying ceremonies took place a few days ago, commemorating the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Americans of the World War II generation and their children remember that day, I think, as a milestone in the fight to preserve American freedom. And some of my younger listeners may only have a vague idea of what it was all about. What was D-Day, Mark, and was it a milestone in history as it's presented?
Well, D-Day, of course, was the American-British landing on Normandy, France, on June 6, 1944. As a purely historical event, it was important because it was the largest naval operation in history. But it's presented in our media, and quite a lot just in the last few days, as a kind of central turning point of World War II. There's a tendency, naturally, by everyone in every society to look to project the present back onto the past. And that's nowhere more evident than in how we look at D-Day, because it was the very important great military operation by the United States in the Second World War in Europe. But it's very misleading in the way that that landing is presented. For one thing, the D-Day invasion did not decisively change the outcome of the Second World War. Now, I know that sounds incredible, given all that we've heard about that, but the D-Day landing took place less than a year before the end of the war in Europe. The war ended in Europe in May 1945. The landing in D-Day was June 1944. The decisive battles of the Second World War had already been fought on the Eastern Front. And in the emphasis on D-Day is a kind of playing down of the much more important military role that the Soviet forces played in World War II. Very few people realize that 80%, four-fifths of the German forces in World War II were defeated not on the Western Front, but on the Eastern Front by the Soviet forces. The decisive battles on the Eastern Front had already been fought and lost on the Eastern Front in Stalingrad, which ended, the Battle of Stalingrad ended in early 1943, and then the final German major offensive of the Second World War was the Battle of Kursk, the largest tank battle in history, about which we hear very little in America, and that was in the summer of 1943. So when the American, British, Canadian forces landed on Normandy in June 1944, German forces were already largely destroyed by that time, and Germany was fighting a very, very desperate defensive war. That's why when the American forces landed on D-Day, I think there were only two German airplanes that could be could take to the air to even fight off landing armada. The German Air Force was very, very hard-pressed, what was left of it, and even defending the German homeland, which was under intense Allied bombardment from the air at that time, and, of course, on the Eastern Front. So the Battle of D-Day is important because in our media, in large measure, because it comports with the kind of an American-centric view of the Second World War. But in fact, the role of the Soviet Union is one that many Americans, and especially American leaders, would like to forget. And that brings us to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is remembered in terms of foreign policy achievements, largely as a man who opposed communism. But during the Second World War, the most important American ally in that conflict was, in fact, the Soviet Union. To put it another way, no country did more to defend the Soviet Union, to help the Soviet Union, than did the United States during World War II. And Ronald Reagan spent World War II as a propagandist for the American military. That is, in his actual deeds as a man working in Hollywood, he actually helped the American war effort, which was at that time in alliance with and in concert with the Soviet Union. But that's forgotten a lot today because we want to uphold, and American leaders want to uphold, this kind of myth that on the one side of the Second World War were the bad guys, the tyrants, that is, the Germans and the Japanese, and on the other side, the Allied side, were the good guys. But that, in fact, is not only simplistic, it's just simply wrong. During the Second World War, the most tyrannical regime in the world at that time, the Soviet Union, was on the Allied side, and the most imperialistic regime of the world at that time, that is the British Empire, was also on the Allied side in that conflict. So that looking at history in simplistic terms of good guys and bad guys may make people feel good, and it comports with how we like to have our motion pictures and our books and so forth. It doesn't really correspond with the reality in real historical terms.
Well, the legacy of D-Day, in broad terms, is the legacy of the Second World War. That's how we view it from our media-saturated, as you say, American-centric view. And that was, maybe D-Day wasn't a watershed in the conduct of the war, but that war was a watershed in diminishing traditional Americans' power over our own country and in increasing globalism and in increasing Jewish power. And it was a watershed in breaking down the old order in Europe, destroying not only German power, but French and British power as well. It brought about also the complete collapse of Eastern Europe, which was swallowed up by communism for almost half a century.
Right. Well, there's several points to be made in that regard, I think, and it again relates to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is remembered as the great American conservative president. But his idea of conservatism was really just to uphold and to present the best look, the best view of American history during the Second World War. The decisive conflict of the 20th century, the greatest conflict of the 20th century, was the Second World War, in which the United States fought openly for a new world order in which the United States and the Soviet Union, above all, would rule the entire world. When Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met at Tehran in Iran in 1943, and then at Yalta in 1945, the three men did what they accused the Axis leaders of wanting to do, that is, to decide the fate of the entire planet. And in that, the United States regarded the Soviet Union as not only a worthy ally, but a trustworthy ally, an ally that Roosevelt and the United States was willing and eager, in fact, to cooperate with in ruling the entire world. You know, the simplistic view of how the Second World War was fought is pointed up in the tragedy of Poland. In 1939, Britain and France declared war on Germany because Germany had attacked Poland. And supposedly, British concern or French concern for the sovereignty of Poland was the reason given for the declarations of war against Germany.
Yes.
By the way, a war that Germany and Hitler wanted at all costs to avoid. They didn't want war with Britain and France. But anyway, at the end of that terrible conflict, 6 years later, at the end in 1945, Poland was no more free than it was in 1939. It was swallowed up and brutally occupied by the Soviet Union. So that the principles that Britain and France proclaimed when they declared war on Germany in 1939, and which America proclaimed in fighting the Second World War, were betrayed by the Allied leaders in actually how they conducted the war, and not only permitting but cooperating with the Soviet Union in expanding its tyranny over half of Europe, including Poland, which was the first victim of the Second World War.
How does Jewish power fit into all of that?
Ronald Reagan, throughout his presidency, was very pro-Israel and very pro-Jewish. But he's not alone, of course. Every American president since Harry Truman has been committed to support the state of Israel and to its policies. Now, fortunately for Reagan, the United States was not involved, or there was no great war in the Middle East as there was in 1967 or 1973. And a conflict like the situation in Iraq is one that, for his legacy, thankfully didn't happen. But Ronald Reagan was entirely subordinate to or supportive of Israel and its policies, even though this meant supporting Israel in actions which were violations not only of the principles that we as Americans try to uphold, but even of American law. Now, specifically, in 1982, when Reagan was president, Israel invaded Lebanon. It invaded Lebanon on the basis of a deceitful pretext that the Israeli ambassador in London had been shot by a member of the PLO. In fact, the person who shot the Israeli ambassador in London was not even with the PLO. But on the basis of that pretext, Israel invaded Lebanon, costing thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands of refugees. Enormous destruction was the result. And Ronald Reagan supported Israel in this. One of the speakers at a recent, or several years ago, at an IHR conference was U.S. Congressman Pete McCloskey. And he spoke out at the time on the floor of the House against Israel's violation even of American law in that conflict. But Ronald Reagan put America's special relationship with Israel even above his oath as president to uphold American law. And this was pointed up in the case of that conflict in which America helped or cooperated with Israel in this completely illegal, horrible, destructive invasion of Lebanon. Now, Reagan also, and this is a parallel with the present, in the aftermath of the Lebanese fiasco, the United States sent military troops to Lebanon. And Reagan made a big thing at the time about staying the course, and we were going to have troops there until Lebanon was a free and democratic country. And that this was part of a great campaign to bring democracy and stability to that part of the world. Echoes of exactly the same kinds of rhetoric that we hear from the White House during the past year with regard to the war in Iraq. But in 1983, when a Marine barracks was blown up and 240-some American Marines were killed in that, Reagan cut his losses, abandoned all his rhetoric, and just simply pulled the American troops out. For all his rhetoric, Reagan was a very pragmatic man. He was not a man to have principles stand in the way of political expediency. And he was willing to cut his losses and when things went wrong and things went bad. And I think if he was president and had engaged in a fiasco as we are dealing with now in Iraq, he would have long ago cut his losses and tried to pull out of the thing in the best safe face in the best possible way, whereas George W. Bush seems incapable emotionally of even admitting a mistake. To go back to that again, the legacy, as you say, of D-Day is, especially for Americans, the legacy of World War II. And it wasn't really merely a defeat for Germany in World War II. It was, in a sense, the defeat of Europe, because the great victorious powers of the Second World War were the Soviet Union and the United States, which together imposed a hegemony, an occupation over Europe and the European homeland, the European heart cease to have any independent political power or even cultural vitality of its own after that, and was subordinate to the United States in the West and the Soviet Union in the East. Now, the legacy of that whole period is now receding into the past, because the Soviet Union has disappeared as a power and a force, but the cultural and intellectual legacy persists in that Europeans have been browbeaten by decades of propaganda. The Second World War really was the triumph in 1945 of a principle of egalitarianism and universalism. And those principles are fundamentally at odds with any kind of patriotic or conservative principles. And that's part of the paradox or the contradiction of the Reagan legacy. He's remembered as a conservative, but what did he actually conserve?
Good question.
What did he actually conserve? When this morning on the radio, in a tribute to Ronald Reagan, one commentator said, he was a president that made us feel good about ourselves. Well, that's true, but that's about all he did. He made us feel good, but in terms of conserving or preserving anything of real substance, Ronald Reagan presided over America's forward advance in the same direction, or backward advance in the same direction it had been going in since the 1940s and has been going in since then. When Ronald Reagan was elected president, many conservatives thought that Reagan was going to make good on his rhetoric and dismantle, for example, the unconstitutional portions of the federal government, such as the Department of Education, which had no constitutional validity. There's nothing in the Constitution to permit the federal government to be involved in education.
Yes, I can remember all of that in 1980, Mark. It was almost a sense of euphoria. He was going to reclaim America. He was going to make the America back into the old America that people felt had been betrayed and abandoned.
Exactly. But to the amazement of many of his conservative followers, he did none of that. He didn't dismantle the federal government. He expanded it. The irony is that his actual policies were in contradiction to his principles, supposedly as a conservative, and even his rhetoric. But most Americans didn't really care, because the hardcore of his supporters, his kind of patriotic Americans, were satisfied with the mere trappings and symbols and mythology of America rather than the reality.
Well, we've seen some of that in these celebrations of his life that we've seen since he's died. For many people, I think he still embodies the old America, the America he helped destroy while he was paying lip service to it. Do you think that now that he's gone, Americans are going to wake up from this illusion that we've really had a continuity of government?
Whatever the harmful effects of his policies, it's hard to dislike Reagan, because he was such an affable guy. Apparently, in his private life, he was kind, courteous to people. He wasn't deceitful. That is, he believed, really, the things that he said. But what Americans are mourning, I think, this week with the death of Ronald Reagan is not merely a man, but an America that's past and which he personified. The America that Ronald Reagan believed in, that he came out of, is an America that's gone. It's an America of Norman Rockwell paintings. It's an America of Leave It to Beaver television. It's America of It's a Wonderful Life, the movie that everybody is very familiar with, especially at Christmas time. It's an America that's existed to some degree before the Second World War, up until the 1940s or 50s. But an America that just doesn't exist anymore. The Los Angeles that Ronald Reagan lived in the 1940s or 50s, that Los Angeles is gone forever. And so California itself is changing dramatically. And what many Americans are mourning with his passing, I think, is that America that's gone. Now, will Americans wake up? I think that, in fact, a number of commentators have made this point, that the president that we now have, who also calls himself a conservative, isn't able to pull it off the way that Ronald Reagan was, not merely because he's not as smooth as Ronald Reagan, but because the reality is now harder and harder to avoid. The reality that the America that so many Americans would like or nostalgically look back upon is really gone. And having said that, though, the great majority, I think, of supporters of George Bush, his hardcore supporters, are still impressed by and loyal to the kind of trappings or the mythology of America, and which is now very different than the reality.
Well, I remember Ronald Reagan signing the Martin Luther King holiday bill. I remember his unkept promises to roll back the intrusive judicial and other federal power over us. I remember his giving an award to Elie Wiesel, his continuance and expansion of the anti-European American policies of all the previous administrations, including the Roosevelt administration. It's hard not to see Reagan, from my point of view, as a man who perhaps did believe in the old America, but just wasn't quite bright enough to understand that the employers who handled him, who organized his campaigns, who were behind him all the time, were destroying that old America.
Ronald Reagan, yes, personifies that contradiction, that paradox. The belief that somehow the old America that he loved and that he was part of could somehow be kept in place or preserved while at the same time supporting and promoting policies that inevitably must destroy that very America that he loved and was a part of. That's the tragedy of it all. I mean, presuming he is sincere. I saw Ronald Reagan speak in person only once, and that was at a large gathering of Holocaust survivors of all places in Washington, D.C. And as he usually was, he was very eloquent on that occasion. But what he did was give a tremendous boost during his administration to Jewish power. And a power that was working and has been working feverishly to tear down, to corrode the very America that Ronald Reagan loved and represented. And as you say, I mean, was he stupid or just ignorant or whatever? I think it's part of the mythology of America that that people from whatever background can come to this country and somehow through a kind of magic can be made into the America of motion pictures and Norman Rockwell paintings.
Well, some ethnicities melt better than others, and I think the
well, of course, I mean, that's part of the biggest thing is no group, no ethnic group, no religious group in America is so determined to preserve and hold on to and further the interests of its own group, as are Jews. No group is as self-aware, as focused, as determined as are Jews in America. And that's not surprising because Jews have been focused, determined, and with a very, very high sense of self-purpose, self-identity for centuries. In fact, If Jews didn't have such a very, very strong sense of self, of peoplehood, they would have long ago disappeared as a people under the pressures of assimilation and so forth. But in America, as in every other country where Jews have settled in large numbers, they persist and insist on furthering their own interests, even as those interests clash and compete and with the interests of the people among whom they live here in this country and elsewhere.
Well, if Ronald Reagan understood that about his employers, then he's a much more subtle person than I take him to be. I tend to think that he was a man with a magnetic personality, but I think he had a nearly empty mind, and that made him a perfect quote-unquote leader type for those who surrounded him. And after all, did he not take Jewish direction in Hollywood in his radio network jobs? And all through his career as a politician, was he not surrounded by powerful Jews?
Well, Margaret Thatcher, who of course is going to be here in the United States for the Reagan funeral and who was an ally of Ronald Reagan's when she was Prime Minister of Britain, said privately at one occasion, well, he's a great guy, but there's very little between his head. I don't think Reagan did understand these larger things, but what drove him, what kept him going, was a kind of mythology about America. And it's an attractive mythology. I think in life, most people, certainly most people in a kind of electorate or collective, prefer a pleasant lie to an unpleasant truth. And Ronald Reagan was a master at telling people the pleasant untruths that they wanted to hear.
Well, you at the Institute are trying to, in some sense, give people enough perspective to see some of those dangers ahead. Can you tell us what lesson you'd like to leave my listeners with on these subjects?
Well, the best guide to the future is an understanding of the past. And that means not just American history, but world history. This is very difficult here in the United States in many ways, because this is a country in which there's a kind of national mythology that America is an exception from history. The idea that we can be exceptions from history is childish, and it's only through an understanding of history, of the past, that we can have a real understanding of our present plight and to think wisely and intelligently about the future. And the power of a historical consciousness is an immensely important one. It's one of the reasons why Jews are as successful as they are, because, in fact, the entire religion underscores, emphasizes a sense of history of Jewish peoplehood. Now, it's a distorted, kind of odd, mythologized history, but nonetheless, it's a sense of history. Americans, as a people, generally have a great difficulty with that, because we are encouraged in this country to think of ourselves as individuals. And people who think of themselves as individuals are not going to think much about history, because as individuals, we die. A historical consciousness also carries with it an awareness of the continuity of history, and that we are part of something larger than ourselves. And that's one of the reasons, again, why history is so important, and why the work of the IHR is important in that regard, because fostering historical awareness and historical consciousness among Americans is a task really of very, very high importance.
Mark, I want to thank you for the work you're doing for Ernst Zundel, of course. I also want to thank you for what is always a bracing intellectual adventure, being on our show and talking to me. And I want to thank you for the work you're doing to bring the truth to light through the Institute for Historical Review.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and it's always a pleasure to be on your show, and I admire your work as well.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a presentation of American Dissident Voices. The program was sponsored as a public service by National Vanguard Books, America's foremost supplier of patriotic books and tapes. You may purchase a high-fidelity audio recording of this program or any earlier program for $12.95 postpaid. In ordering program tapes, be sure to mention the date and the subject of the program and the call letters of this radio station. For $2, we'll send you our newest 72-page illustrated catalog with descriptions and ordering information for more than 600 books and tapes of interest to patriots. Many of the items in the National Vanguard Books catalog are available nowhere else. Our mailing address is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Please write that address down now, because you may not hear this program again on this station. The forces of political correctness do not believe in free speech, and they do not like this program. Our address again is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, that's 90, Hillsboro, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Visit us on the internet at www.natvan.com. That's spelled NATVAN.com. Or www.natall.com. That's spelled NATALL.com. These American Dissident Voices programs are sponsored by donations from listeners like yourself. Please send a donation today to help us keep these programs on the air. This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.